You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. We bring expertise on international affairs from Stanford's campus straight to you. I'm Michael McFaul, the host of World Class and director of the Freeman Spogli Institute. Today we have three guests, a first for World Class, who have, with me, co-authored a new white paper beginning to be put out by FSI in just a few days called Global Populisms and Their Challenges. It explores the threats that populism poses to democracy and what we might do about it to alleviate those problems in the future. We have with us first Professor Anna Jamawa Busa. We just talked for many, many minutes about how to pronounce her first part of her name, and I just screwed it up again. She's the director of the Europe Center here at FSI and a senior fellow at FSI and also in the Department of Political Science with me. We also have Dr. Didi Kuo with us today, associate director of research and senior research scholar at the Center on Democracy Development and Rule of Law here at FSI. Last but not least, Dr. Frank Fukuyama. Let's call him Frank. Frank Fukuyama, who's the director of CDDRL, also a senior fellow here at FSI. Thank you all for being on World Class today.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Mike.
Let's start with definitions. Populism is a word that lots of people use in lots of different contexts, and maybe for more historical reasons that I don't even know. How would we start with a kind of base level definition of what is populism and what is not populism? Anna, maybe we start with you.
So in this paper, we followed the definition that a political scientist named Cass Moody developed earlier. And it's a very simple definition. Basically, all populist parties and politicians make two claims. The first claim is that the elites are a corrupt and self-serving cartel. Whether they're political, academic, media, or professional elites, they all form this self-serving cartel. And that, too, as a result, the general will of the people has to be better represented. That the people, qua the people, have to be better represented against this overweening cartel.
How's that different from democracy?
Well, it's very much a criticism of democracy, right? Mm-hmm. So rather than sort of, and it doesn't call for a specific set of solutions or institutions, it is basically a fundamental critique. That's a very thin sort of ideology. It can go with left or right-wing appeals. It can be anti or pro-democratic, but fundamentally it's a criticism of how liberal democracy functions.
Didi or Frank, would you add to that or subtract from it, or we all agree?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think also one element is who the people are, because the populists on the right usually don't mean the whole people living in the territory of the country. They mean maybe a certain dominant ethnic group or formerly dominant ethnic group, whereas the ones on the left tend not to make that distinction so much.
Interesting. Didi?
Anna's definitely right that it is a sort of a thin ideology. It's not one that is attached to any set of positions necessarily, but populism does sort of rely on democracy, at least populist governance. Populist leaders typically used democratic institutions and means to come to power, and then once in power, go after the sort of liberal foundations of democracy.
Right. So it's a two-step process.
Right. And potentially go after democratic institutions themselves.
Mm-hmm. Do autocrats use populist methods? Do they need to? Some do, some don't. How would we think about them? I'm thinking of Putin, of course. Is he a populist?
I think he uses populist rhetoric.
Uh-huh.
You know, again, this sort of notion of, you know, we the people, we the Russian people, we the Russian non-Chechen, non-Caucasus people. But I don't think he makes any claims about criticizing the elite. And he's not functioning in a democracy, so there's not much of a democratic critique there.
Interesting. And what about Xi, just to round out?
Well, I think Xi actually gets support from ordinary Chinese that don't like the elites in China because they think they're corrupt, and Xi is protecting them from these elites. But, you know, again, you can't get to be more elite yourself than Xi Jinping, who's a person. I'm not sure it's really quite comparable to anything you see in Western democracies.
Right. And that's the paradox, of course, with Putin, too. He's been in power for 20 years. So this project started a couple years ago, Global Populisms, I would note. There's an S at the end there, and let's explain that in a minute. Why did this project not begin 30 years ago? What has happened recently that has brought your attention as scholars to this set of issues? Didi, let's start with you.
At the Center on Democracy Development and the Rule of Law, at least, we've long sort of assumed that there are places that are still sort of in the process of democratizing or in the process of developing, and then there are places that have sort of completed the process.
Right.
But we began a program on American democracy and comparative perspective in 2013 because we noticed that there were plenty of ongoing problems with our democracy, such as polarization or inequality. And then in 2016, with the election of Trump in the same year that the Brexit referendum happened and Marine Le Pen makes it to the final round of the French national election.
All in 1 year.
All in 1 year, you realize that perhaps the discontent that we see in our country and in other established democracies is pervasive. Potentially it has similar causes. Immigration, the refugee and migrant crisis in Western Europe also spurred a lot of potential illiberalism, the rise of the far right. So it just seems like there were a lot of dots that needed to be connected.
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue that 2016 is sort of the peak of a wave that had been building for far earlier than that.
Okay.
So we see support for populist parties rising in Western Europe starting in the mid-1990s and really sort of capitalizing on all kinds of issues surrounding immigration, welfare chauvinism, worries about the welfare state. In the post-communist democracies in Europe, you see them basically already getting much more of a vote, you know, polling over 25%, starting with the first elections, and then also rising up. So I think this has been building for a while. It's just that what we're seeing now is really some of the effects of this wave crashing on our shores, but it's been building up.
You already got into one of the major factors, or at least it's been hypothesized, about immigration. Help us understand, is that true across all cases? Frank, you've written about Canada, Australia, and the United States, comparing them where you discuss different outcomes. Let's start with immigration and then maybe talk about economic issues. But how do we understand the relationship between immigration, generally speaking, take it any way you want, and the rise of populists?
Well, I think that it speaks to a cultural fear. So first of all, there's been a lot of immigration as a result of globalization. So for example, Germans didn't think of themselves as a country of immigrants, but now they have more foreign-born people in Germany than in the United States. And so things
really
have been
I didn't even know that.
It's really quite remarkable. So there's been a lot of movement, especially within Europe, because, you know, within Europe, they've encouraged open borders. And I think it leads to rather rapid cultural change, and particularly the Syrian migrant crisis in 2014 was a big trigger, because all of a sudden a million non-white, non-European people show up in Central Europe, in a part of the world that's not used to this sort of thing, and it produced these big fears that this was going to lead to cultural replacement, or what the right calls cultural replacement. And so I do think this is language that Donald Trump himself uses and
mm-hmm.
a lot of his supporters, so I think it is something that binds a lot of these groups together.
And I think Frank is right that it's not just about immigration, but who is doing the immigrating. So Poland, for example, has over 1.5 million Ukrainian immigrants living within its borders, and they've absolutely posed no political problem. No one's tried to attack them, no one tried to make political hay out of their existence. But this is the same country that refused to accept a single Syrian refugee during the 2015 immigration crisis.
Wow. Interesting. And yet, there are some countries, well, let's just compare Canada to the United States. Why isn't there a Trump-like figure in Canada?
Yeah, well, my argument about that is it really is also about state control.
Okay.
So both Canada and Australia have significantly higher numbers of foreign-born than the United States does, but really no big populist movement. The Ford brothers are about as close as Canada comes. And I think that that is because they actually have a legal regime to control immigration. They both have a point system. Most of the immigrants that come in actually have a higher level of education than native-born Canadians. And so it's less culturally disruptive, and mostly it's the state has the thing under control. And I think that's the idea, that you're not controlling your borders, is one of the things that populist politicians have been exploiting to their political benefit.
One of the points that we try to make in the paper is that a lot of the grievances that drive populism are real, but
right.
politicians haven't necessarily responded to them. This is the point about the failure of mainstream parties. You know, in a democracy, you both want to encourage liberal values, and in the United States, it's a country built on immigration, but at the same time, you do have immigration laws that need to be enforced clearly, and decisions made in a sort of deliberative manner of who gets to come and who doesn't. And those borders are sort of a fact of the nation state, even in highly democratic countries. So one of the points we make in the paper is that at some point, politicians need to make difficult choices and acknowledge that there are trade-offs, but clearly delineate what these policies are and try to sell them to a public in a way that hasn't necessarily been done effectively.
Right. I want to come back to parties in a minute, because I think that's a real central theme of the paper. But let's dig a little bit more into another factor that's related to immigration, but not necessarily. That's globalization, worker displacement. I just heard literally on television last night, the first time I ever think I heard this, that Bill Clinton destroyed America because he let China into the World Trade Organization. A critique of a Republican on TV just yesterday. It was really quite emphatic that that was the pivotal moment. How should we understand that variable? And how do we understand it, you know, in the United States versus Europe?
Well, I think, you know, globalization means several different things, right? It's the flow of capital, but it's also the flow of people, it's also the flow of investment, and so on. Each of these contributes to the rise of populism, but it doesn't have to. So much of this is about the sort of policy solutions to this, attempts to compensate people for this, or even the recognition that globalization poses these problems. And so you see, you know, these sort of blips on the American political landscape where people articulate their grievances against globalization, whether it's the WTO talks in Seattle or, you know, the 1% movement, but they're never really taken up by the elites. And I think that's, again, been one of these things that's been building up for a while, and it didn't have to lead to populism, but it did because the mainstream parties and the mainstream politicians refused to acknowledge it and instead treat it as an unalloyed good.
And one thing that did happen across the United States and Europe in the 1990s, I mean, is Bill Clinton the root of all of this? I don't know. But certainly the political movement of centrism and the third way that, you know, there were these third way conferences that would happen with...
In Europe and the United States,
right?
Right,
between
yeah.
Clinton and Tony Blair,
right.
Ronald Prodi, Schroeder, just all these Western European politicians that tried to sort of reinvigorate social democracy for the 21st century. And
right.
the way they did that was a lot of wholesale adoption of policies of the right, including a total consensus that globalization was a pretty unalloyed good. There was a lot of eroding of labor unions in the United States that was not helped by democratic administrations, I mean, sometimes accelerated under them. This convergence on economic policy accelerated the trends of globalization and of inequality, a lot of which are being disentangled now by social scientists, didn't do much to cater to the traditional working class base. If anything, often ignored their demands and needs.
Yeah, also I think that there was a certain amount of dishonesty, you know, that the economic theory told you that free trade was a good thing in the aggregate, but it would hurt working class people. And the typical response from the economists was, well, we'll compensate them by giving them job training or unemployment benefits, and almost never did that actually materialize. And so I think a lot of working class Americans after China entered the WTO have a reasonable gripe that they lost their jobs as a result of this. You know, the companies got richer, but they and their children really suffered. And as Dee said, the elites really didn't do anything about this.
This is just an anecdote, but my parents both worked in they both worked in IT in Atlanta, Georgia, and my mom had to train her replacement workers. The company was going to be it was bought by an Indian conglomerate, and all the jobs were going to be outsourced to India, and so the American workers just spent months training their replacements, and then the offices were shuttered. And, you know, it's just this story that happened everywhere, and David Autor at MIT has done really good work on communities in the United States that were particularly hit by China's accession to the WTO. There were so many communities that were decimated as a result of these trends, and no policy solutions in those communities.
Well, go ahead. Yeah.
And I think, you know, on the specific issue of the Chinese accession to the WTO, that was very much a political decision, much like
right.
adopting the euro was a political decision,
right.
where the economic fundamentals didn't necessarily all point in the same direction. And, you know, within both sort of sets of administrations, there was a lot of sort of conflict over whether or not to do this. And unfortunately, you know, these political decisions then ought to have had political solutions for the consequences, and that never materialized.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. Why didn't it? I mean, in the paper, we spend some time talking about the failure of political parties, right, on both the left and the right. Why was it that they could get away with so long without addressing that? And what's happened to, I don't even know what the right word is, mainstream center-right, center-left parties? They seem a lot weaker today than they were a decade ago. Is that a consequence of populism? Is that a consequence of their bad political decisions on these very issues? Before we move to other things, solutions, let's figure out what share of blame should go to center-right and center-left parties.
Well, center-left, a lot is being written and has been written on the decline of the center-left. There's great work by Sherry Berman and Stephanie Mudge and others showing that neoliberalism, I suppose, is a sort of broad and all-encompassing term, but that as the parties of the left embraced sort of neoliberal policies, they weren't able to develop real policy solutions or mobilize new constituencies around new policies that could provide any kind of safety net or improve the quality of life and address the rising amounts of sort of risk and precarity that individuals are increasingly being asked to bear in this highly sort of financialized and globalized economy. And parts of the reason are that the elites themselves were the leaders of these parties, and they adopted sort of new modes of representation, new methods of policy making that didn't integrate as many perspectives from, say, the grassroots or
mm-hmm.
from traditional associational linkages that parties had formed,
right.
and rather based a lot of decision-making purely on ideas that were coming from economists, ideas coming from lobbyists, at the private sector, about what could generate growth. And there was a hope that economic growth could, you know, a rising tide could lift all ships,
everybody,
and that ultimately the policies that they would need would not be ones that were dependent on the state or state resources. But it just, there was just a vacuum left where traditional policy solutions had been, which allowed grievances to sort of grow in the meantime.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I think, frankly, there was a class interest. You know, most of the elites were educated professionals,
yeah, that's right,
who benefited from having cheap labor in the form of a gardener or a nanny, you know, coming from a less developed country, and they were actually doing fine, and their jobs initially were not the ones that were being threatened.
Right. And there is some empirical work showing that as economic policy became a less contested area, that symbolic and cultural debates took on increasing resonance in campaigns.
Right.
So we do know there's a distinction on the right and the left, but a lot of the sort of big policy, quote unquote, debates that were occurring were not necessarily about, you know, should the state be more redistributive or not? A lot of those big questions were sort of taken off the table.
Yeah, I totally agree that on the center left, it's a sort of inability to basically continue to protect your traditional constituencies,
yeah,
and to actually address what the grievances might be. It's an abandonment of those constituencies for this economic middle road. But I think on the center right also is to blame,
yes,
right? And that's, you know, the story that Daniel Ziblatt tells, that historically, if center right parties don't fully buy into liberal democracy, and if they don't co-opt the sort of more extremist populists on the right side, then what you have basically is the erosion of democracy from that side as well.
Right.
And so I think what's happening is that the center-left basically and the center-right have both grown far too complacent and far too non-responsive.
Well, that's a good point to pivot to what should be done. The paper ends with some prescriptions, some very ambitious ones, some smaller ones. Discuss with our listeners some of the things that can be changed to end this, what sounds like a pretty negative dynamic, and a dynamic that's not just bad for the interests of the voters, but as discussed in the paper, the future of liberal democracy. So how can this trajectory be changed? And I know these are huge, giant questions generalizing about the entire world, but, you know, start with Europe and the United States, maybe.
I think we can summarize them as a set of new commitments, new coalitions, and potentially new institutions. And so the new commitments have to be to the rule of law, to transparency, to fighting corruption, and to equality before law, all of things that both the left and the right have abandoned and populists have very much eroded. When it comes to coalitions, I think we need to build broad coalitions in the name of, in the United States, for example, equality of opportunity and of sort of, you know, the American way being the provision of that equality of opportunity, rather than targeting specific groups and attempting to pick off, you know, build an electoral coalition in this willy-nilly way. And I think finally, our institutional recommendations really boil down to renewing faith in the democratic process to make it less politicized, to make it more transparent, and make it more accountable.
Didi? Frank?
That was a beautiful summary. It really was. I do think we identify, and this is an aspect that is potentially ambitious, but it really shouldn't be, that effective leadership also means denouncing any perceived incursion of democratic norms. I mean, there's so much is politicized now that it's difficult to do things in a way that necessarily seems like honorable or above board. But when you hear things about how there are some politicians or members of Congress, for example, that don't like certain behaviors they see in the executive, but also
right,
refuse to do anything about it, you know,
right,
this is how people, citizens, will lose faith in democratic institutions. Or when you see an overt politicization of the administration of law, whether that happens at the state or national level, that's something that is kind of icky to citizens, but needs to be called out and denounced by
right,
people who can actively check that kind of behavior.
Frank?
Parties of the left have to figure out how to recapture the symbolism around the nation, because it's a very powerful feeling that people have. They want to belong to a community. And the left, you know, over the last 30 years has fractured into a lot of different partial identities, and there's no sense of this broader community. On the right, the problem is that that community is being hijacked into one based on race and ethnicity, and that's also a very bad thing. And so the idea that you have a broader democratic civic identity that all Americans share, I think, is important culturally to give people the idea that they're living actually in the same community.
And are you optimistic or pessimistic that we can achieve that here first in America, then we'll talk about other places?
I think that our politics is so polarized that that in itself prevents the emergence of these more integrating strategies. I really don't see a single leader on the horizon that I have a lot of confidence will be able to do that.
Didi, optimist or pessimist?
I think politicians respond to incentives, and if there emerges a strong sense that the public is sort of fed up enough, then it's possible that some members of parties will respond in a way, in the way that Anna was discussing, it, to create coalitions that are sort of new and mobilized around a potential realignment of traditional policies of the left and right or traditional social and cultural issues. But it's hard to build a strong case for optimism right now.
The last word. Tell us what you really think.
I totally share Frank and Didi's pessimism about the United States. I'm much more optimistic about Europe. Because there, across the board, in both new and older democracies, you see both electorates plumping for anti-corruption, anti-populist candidates. This is, you know, taking, it took place in Slovakia and Croatia and the most recent Slovak elections in Greece, where voters are basically saying, we've had enough. And secondly, what you also see is the rise of sort of elite cordon sanitaires that are being erected around populist, potential populist leaders. And you saw that in France when the elite sort of banded together to make sure Marine Le Pen wouldn't win. And you see that most recently in Italy, where basically Salvini's power grab was denied to him by the other elites. I'm very bullish on Europe.
Yes.
Well, let's end on a bullish note about Europe. Maybe we should all get together after the next presidential election here in the United States and kind of re-up our assessments, both empirical and normative, about the future of populism in America. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
You've been listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. If you like this episode, please review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps new listeners find the show. And be sure to subscribe to stay up to date on what's happening in the world and why.